Hi, everyone. It's Monday, and you're with us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Fewer than 200 people attended the Justice for J6 rally in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. There were more police and journalists than angry protesters on hand for the gathering. It had been advertised as a show of support for the rioters who attacked and breached the Capitol on January 6. Sparse attendance this weekend should not be understood as a triumphant defeat of the troubling ideologies which fueled insurrectionist violence in January. Stopping further acts of violence by political extremists is critically important, but it's only a starting point for responding to January 6. It's equally important for us to understand and interrupt the ideologies that fueled those actions. University of Chicago professors Bob Pate and Kevin Ruby studied the Capitol rioters and found that they were distinct from the general profile of the far right. The overwhelming majority had no ties to established right-wing groups, and these rioters were far more representative of the general population. In a discussion of their study results published in The Atlantic, Pape and Ruby write, quote, "Unlike the stereotypical extremists, many of the alleged participants in the Capitol riot have a lot to lose. They work as CEOs, shop owners, doctors, lawyers, IT specialists, and accountants." In short, it's possible the violence of January 6 was not the result of American extremism. It was an outgrowth of American mainstreamism. In July, U.S. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn testified before Congress, and he recounted his terrifying encounter with rioters who understood their actions as wholly American, even responsive to the directive of the American president.
More and more insurrectionists were pouring into the area by the speaker's lobby near the rotunda, and some wearing MAGA hats and shirts that said Trump 2020. I told them to just leave the Capitol, and in response they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here. We're here to stop the steal."
So if American identity is at the center of the Capitol insurrectionist rage, it's about this fundamental struggle over whose house this is and who has a right to hold power. American identity is sometimes unspoken at the center of many of our current debates. Voting rights, a struggle over who deserves to wield power. Critical race theory, a struggle over who deserves to shape the story of American history. Immigration policy, a struggle over who will write the story of America's future. Here to help us understand the content and context of these struggles is Mei Nye, professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia University and author of The Chinese Question. Professor Nye, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So, Professor Nye, you've written, "If we don't understand the history of exclusion, we cannot understand racist hatred." What are some of the connections between policies of exclusion and white supremacy?
Melissa, the United States is unique among most nations because people who are immigrants actually have a path to citizenship. That is, if they are legal immigrants. And so it's fairly easy to become a citizen if you're an immigrant. So if you really want to keep people out of the citizenry, you have to keep them from coming from the country. And that's where immigration restriction and exclusion are intimately tied to the question of citizenship.
Is this also, when you talk about the relative ease of citizenship, is this also about the 14th Amendment birthright citizenship? Is this something that we see in other nations around the world?
Absolutely. Some other countries that have birthright citizenship also restrict it to descendants of citizens or even ethnic restrictions. So the United States does provide citizenship fairly easily to anyone born here and anyone who can naturalize after 5 years of residence and a clean record.
Okay, so what's valuable about U.S. citizenship? Why desire it? Why is it valuable for those who come in and seek it?
Citizenship in the United States gives you basically two things. First is the right not to be kicked out, right not to be banished or deported. And the second is the right to vote. And hence you see a lot of the furor around citizenship, around voting rights right now, because it has the right to vote that's at stake.
When you hear "Make America Great Again," and then even after the end of the Trump presidency, the desire to hold on to a presidency that for some group was making America great again. What else do you hear in the sort of undercurrent of that?
What I hear is make America white again, or make America controlled by white people again. And I think this is really problematic, because citizenship has always been contested. It's always been a question about, notwithstanding the legal rights to citizenship that are afforded to broad swaths of people, it's also been the subject of controversy about who should even have that access. So immigrants from Europe had a very easy path to citizenship in the 19th century, but people of color have been kept out of that circle. Obviously, we know about Dred Scott, which denied Black people the right to be citizens, including free Blacks. And after the Civil War, with the 14th Amendment and the creation of national citizenship for all, including African Americans, I mean, we know, right, the 14th Amendment essentially repeals Dred Scott. But then you have the problem of other peoples, right, of Chinese in particular, who were not even coming in large numbers, but the idea that Chinese could become a community in the West Coast to begin with, and then later in the country, was abhorrent to mainstream white Americans. And hence you have the exclusion laws keeping Chinese from immigrating and keeping all Chinese from naturalized citizenship.
I remember you and I were colleagues at the University of Chicago, and it was grappling with your work that for the first time as a Southerner, I'd heard all the stories of basically Atlantic immigration and forced in migration through the triangle trade of enslavement. And then, of course, sort of the European stories about the in-migration that was voluntary. And then, of course, our country has been obsessed for years now with the kind of migration across the southern border. But I was less aware of the ways that we had policed the Pacific migration and in-migration. Can you say a few words about that and what we can learn about sort of the American story from the Pacific theater of immigration?
The Pacific story is actually very connected to the South and the Atlantic, because what drove Americans, white Americans, especially across the continent in the early 19th century, was the struggle to extend slavery. Right? Western expansion is driven by the sectional conflict over slavery, right? Each side wants more states so they can have more control in the Congress. So Western expansion is driven by sectional politics over slavery. And it's also driven by an ideology, which we call manifest destiny, which is the idea that the entire continent belongs to white people, that it's God's gift to white people. So it doesn't matter if you roll over Native Americans along the way, dispossess thousands and hundreds of thousands of indigenous peoples from their land. It's this whole idea that the continent belongs to whites. And once they get to the Pacific coast, they can look behind them to see what they've conquered, but they also look towards the Pacific and they see all new possibilities of more conquest, but they also see the possibility of people from Asia coming to North America. And so this combination of racism and expectation leads to a racially driven movement to keep out people from the Pacific while still encouraging people from the Eastern United States to go west. And people who went west were not just Northern white Americans, they also came from the South. During the Gold Rush, white Southerners went to California, and a lot of them brought their slaves with them to help them mine for gold.
Can you also just reflect for a moment on the Dawes Act of 1924? I mean, there's a moment when citizenship is actually imposed, right, on indigenous communities.
Right. Well, the Dawes Act, starting in the late 19th century, created a different kind of policy towards Native Americans, which was to forcibly assimilate them, right, by saying that, oh, we'll give you your land that you can own in fee simple. You can own your land as individuals, and then maybe you'll learn to be like a white person by being a farmer. And this was really a trick to have Native Americans sell their lands to white people, right? So there's this process of forced assimilation or stripping of their sovereign rights as Native nations or tribes. And then in 1924, there's the American Indian Citizenship Act, which imposes citizenship on all Native American peoples. And in my view, that is not an act of inclusion. That is an act of final exclusion, in the sense that Native peoples are stripped entirely or almost entirely of their sovereign rights. So this is where the treaties really go down the drain.
You know, many times in our kind of contemporary discourse, I feel like we presume that exclusionary immigration policies are partisan. And particularly during the administration of President Trump, there was a lot of media coverage of some of the horrors that we saw at the southern border. But it's worth noting that both President Trump's predecessor and his successor, President Obama, and now President Biden, have been fairly exclusionary in their immigration policies and practices. How do we get past a sort of partisan narrative about it to really think about how American it is to try to close our borders, exclude and push folks out?
I think Biden's proposal for immigration that's now in the Congress, it's not moving anywhere right now, obviously, because they have other things that they're prioritizing. That's actually a good reform, I think. It really does open up immigration. It reunites families. It increases the number of green cards that will be available for people. But Biden is still saddled with the problem of America's geopolitical imperial legacies in parts of the world, which are driving refugees to leave their countries, violence in Central America. And so he has to grapple with that problem. And it's a problem he didn't make, but it's a longstanding problem of American politics. And, you know, actually, when it comes to foreign policy, Biden is not as progressive as he is on many domestic policies. So immigration is both a domestic question insofar as it concerns communities that live among us and who are us also and have rights in this country, but it's also very much a foreign policy question. And this is where I think the Biden people fall down in many ways.
Mei Dai is professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia University and author of The Chinese Question. Thank you for your time and for your insights.
It was great talking with you, Melissa. Take care.
Thanks. Now, we asked for your reflections about American citizenship and identity. We asked you to take one sentence and tell us what the word citizenship means to you.
Citizenship equals being a good neighbor. Jane Hilson Aiello, Centennial, Colorado.
Hi, this is Keith from Dallas, and being a U.S. citizen, having citizenship is one of the most important things to me. I appreciate it almost every day. My father fought in World War II. I taught in public schools. I pledged allegiance to the flag. I fly my flag proudly. Even though we're in a terrible time right now, I'm glad to be an American citizen.
It means being part of something bigger than myself. Dwight from Bardstown, Kentucky.
I am a native-born American citizen, and for me, being an American citizen is about having the freedom to vote, the freedom to pursue whatever makes me happy, and the freedom to say whatever I would like to say.
Hi, my name is Kim from Bellevue, Nebraska. What does citizenship mean to me? It is absolutely a joy. I served in the military for 6 years, but it's more than that. I find it wonderful and joyous and challenging to be an American. I appreciate the freedoms and the responsibilities I have as a citizen. I'm also in the only country on earth that calls itself in its founding documents an experiment. That's where the challenge comes in. Our nation was built with a good deal of racism and classism and misogyny and colonialism. And our challenge to move forward is how can we be a great country and, move away from those bad things. We can do it. We can do it.
Hi, this is Bailey from Moorhead, Minnesota. To me, America is about responsibility. We have so many choices left up to ourselves to make. And to me, that means that we need to take responsibility to make choices that benefit more than just ourselves and our families.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. I am luckier than lucky to have been born in the United States. the freedoms that are available to me demand that I give back to this country and pay my fair share for all the opportunities that I've been given.
Hello, this is Connie from Blairsville, Pennsylvania. American citizenship means not only do I have freedoms, I have a responsibility to ensure I am willing to stand for those Americans whose freedoms are challenged by prejudice and racism in order to ensure all Americans are guaranteed the inalienable right stated in the first line of the Constitution.
We love it when you talk with us. So remember, you can send us a voice recording to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Okay, right back at it with you. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and it's time for a Monday pop quiz. I promise it's easy. Just one question. Which European country is America's oldest ally? All right, pens down. Did you guess England? It's a fair mistake, given our shared language and the American obsession with all things royal family. But no, Great Britain is the imperial power the upstart American colonists fought off in order to establish this little experiment in democracy we call the United States. Our oldest ally is France. French military power secured the American Revolution. Our Constitution was not ratified until 1789, but that was nearly a decade after we'd established official diplomatic ties with France. In 1944, we stormed the beaches of Normandy to liberate the French from Nazi occupation. And sure, we've had our tensions over the years. Remember the Freedom Fries madness back in 2003 when France wasn't down with our invasion of Iraq? Well, by the way, they weren't wrong about that. But through it all, France has been our ace, our road dog, our bilateral BFF. Until Friday, when France pulled its ambassador to the U.S. out of Washington, D.C. Now, I'm going to say that again just so you don't miss it. Our diplomatic relationship with France is older than our Constitution. And for the first time in the history of our nation, there's no French ambassador in D.C. The issue? A submarine deal with Australia worth hundreds of billions of dollars. But I just have to wonder, what's a couple hundred billion after 200 years of international cooperation? Is something else going on here? We're joined now by Ryan Heath, host of Politico's Global Insider podcast and newsletter. Ryan, great to have you here.
Likewise. That was a real introduction.
So, Ryan, what is going on here? Is this just about the sub deal?
Well, it's really all about China and the fact that Australia, my home country, is very worried about the shadow that China casts in security and in economic terms over the region. And the fact that the US understands that it was really sleeping at the wheel a little bit about how it engages with this rising power. And one of the ways that this has all come to a head is that Australia is America's closest ally in the region. So the best way to play catch up on China is to make sure Australia is effectively being the 24/7 cop for the US in the region. And obviously, Australia would love to be the seventh country in the world with nuclear-powered submarines. And so the way to get them is to do this deal with America. And the poor suckers in the process are the French, who had the original contract to supply Australia's new submarines.
So in certain ways, that sounds right to me. It just sounds like, okay, you're securing the Pacific there. There's, you know, I get the kind of hedge, the ways that that we haven't always reflected on China in the most productive ways in terms of international security and economic politics. But why not give your buddies a heads up? Why not chat with France about it? Why not figure out a way to make that deal with Australia while not simply, you know, going around the French in this way?
Exactly. My mother always taught me you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. And this is a recurring theme now, a complaint that a lot of people have had about the new Biden administration, that they can kind of live with the way things happen. They understand that there are a lot of things on the Biden administration's plate. They just don't like how it happens. And for a simple couple of phone calls, a lot of pain could have been saved, I think, is the conclusion of a lot of people observing this process.
So what does it mean for a nation to remove its diplomats and ambassador? I mean, it doesn't mean that we're in like a tension with France, does it? Not a military one, obviously.
No, I mean, it is a tactic. So it's really the clearest way a country has to say, whoa, we have a problem with what's going on here, because you can't ignore an act like that. And it obviously got all of the headlines that France wants. So it doesn't mean that there's a long-term problem, but it does mean there could be a long-term problem if the US doesn't snap back and come to some form of compromise or make amends in some particular way. And they've pulled back their ambassador from Canberra, Australia, as well. So it's not just Joe Biden and Antony Blinken that are on the hook here. We're seeing a bunch of other protests as well. So Emmanuel Macron, the French president, he is not going to speak at the United Nations General Assembly this week in New York. And you might think, hey, what has the UN got to do with any of this? They didn't cancel the contract. But it's a way for Macron to signal how angry he is. So we're seeing a bunch of these protests, and they've ranged from the ambassador being pulled back to a military gala being cancelled last week. And it could be as diverse as a European Union-Australian trade deal being torpedoed. That's something that the French have put on the table over the weekend, saying, you know, if people are going to stab us in the back, we can't fairly or reasonably conduct a trade negotiation with you. So there could be a range of long-term consequences here.
When President Trump wanted to sort of flex his muscles relative to the international community, he was never subtle about it, right? Sometimes, like literally with France, like handshaking, you know, more strongly. I'm wondering if Biden is also purposely sort of trying to display a certain kind of muscularity here.
It's a version of George Bush in a way, more than Donald Trump. It's you're with us or you're against us. Now, no one is saying that France is against the US when it comes to China, but what the administration here is really doing is signaling, well, you need to be more like Australia if you want to be on the American side in dealing with China. And if that means ponying up a bunch of money and being willing to break a contract in order to say, hey, you're all the way with USA on China, then that is a signal that Washington is happy to send at the moment. And one of the prices is this good relationship with France, at least temporarily. But I do think that is their long-term play here.
After 200 years, is Australia just a more valuable strategic ally at this point than France?
It's a tricky one. Australia has fought in every war with the United States since 1899. You've obviously got a lot of those common cultural connections, and the US has to work a bit harder to keep them going with France, the language barrier and all of that. But at the same time, France is a nuclear power. There might be nuclear energy in those submarines when they eventually arrive in Australia, but that's not the same as a bomb. Australia doesn't have a veto on the UN Security Council, and the history is a bit longer with France. So I think this will be repaired in the end. But the idea that Joe Biden's only thinking about calling Emmanuel Macron now, when he could have done it 2 weeks ago, you know, that's going to rob, and the French aren't going to forget that. So they're going to extract a price. In Australia, there might be cash. The Australians are going to have to cut Paris a check. And in the US, there might have to be a little bit of groveling done. And that is not a situation many American presidents find themselves in.
Ryan Heath is the host of Politico's Global Insider podcast and newsletter. Ryan, thanks for walking us through all of that.
It was a pleasure.
We are in a moment of time where the decisions that we make in the next 3 to 5 years will determine the opportunities and the future for the next 3 to 5 generations.
Bostonians understand the work that they'd like me to do as their mayor, and working with them to make sure that I come up with the responses that they need to the problems that we face as a city.
You just heard Michelle Wu and Anissa Asabi George. Both are the daughters of immigrants and longtime city councilors in Boston. And they are the two Democratic women who have emerged as the top candidates in Boston's mayoral race. Kim Janey, a Black woman, is currently serving as the city's acting mayor. But November's general election is the first time in Boston's 200-year history the voters will choose between two women candidates for the city's top job. For more on the Boston mayoral race, we're joined now by Saraya Wintersmith, a reporter covering Boston City Hall for GBH News. Saraya, great to have you here.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
So I do find Boston inscrutable. I can never figure out what y'all are doing there. So let's just walk through this a little bit. First of all, how is it the two Democrats are running against one another for a November general election?
Sure. So we have nonpartisan elections here, and everybody will tell you that they are a Democrat In this case, we've got two different flavors of Democrats. Both of those women that you mentioned are city councilors, and the council is typically a grooming ground for political leadership in Boston. Wu was first elected in 2013, Asabi George in 2015, and they've been part of this shift that's been happening on the council that's brought Boston its most diverse, its majority women and majority people of color. In a lot of ways, it makes sense that these are the two women that we're seeing. They are both at-large councilors, so they campaign in a large pool of candidates, similar to how a primary election works. And in the last two election cycles, both of these women got the most votes in their election cycle. So they were already popular. They already had citywide following. People knew their names. And this is how we see them emerging as competitors for the November general.
So talk about these two different flavors of Democrat. One is a bit to the left and one is a bit more moderate. At least that's how they've been framed. Is that right?
That's the most popular framing that we're seeing now, although both women take issue with the characterizations. Wu gets described as a progressive darling just because she champions things like free transportation and a local Green New Deal to address climate change. Asabi George, people characterize her as a moderate because she was the only candidate in the entire field who was opposed to defunding or reallocation of police resources. So while the rest of the people in the field were saying they're open to figuring out a way to get more money to things like nonprofit groups and community-based organizations, Asabi George has always said, no, I support the police. She's gotten the endorsement of the former police commissioner, and she campaigns on things like adding more officers to the force.
All right, Soraya, so let's talk a little bit more about these issues. You kind of laid out a couple that allow voters to characterize these candidates in particular ways. But what are the top issues that Boston voters are saying they're concerned about and that they want their next mayor to address?
Education has really risen as a top issue for voters here. It's one that I think both of these candidates has an advantage to campaign on because they're both really proud mothers who make a big deal about being moms and moms with students in BPS schools. In the case of Asabi George, the more moderate of the two, she's a former teacher and was for more than a decade. And I think that if you are a single issue voter and education is your deal, who better to fix the schools than someone who has that in-classroom experience?
Now, can you talk about voter turnout during the election? I know this was a primary, it's kind of at an odd time, but my understanding is that turnout was pretty low.
It's an issue that's plagued political figures in Boston for years. Only about a quarter of the city's eligible voters cast ballots in the preliminary election. And turnout was highest in the most conservative sections of the city, more whiter, more affluent sections of the city. Those are the more reliable voters. The most common explanation that I've heard for this is just that municipal elections happen in off year. So last year during the presidential, we saw I think about 68% of voters come out, but this time, again, it was just a quarter, and people always say they need to move elections to coincide with presidential ones.
And that analysis of needing to move elections to coincide with presidential ones is typically an argument made by Democrats in places where there's kind of a partisan split, or it's made by folks who are really making an argument specifically about the diversity of possible candidates, that we see people who are more working class, who are more likely to live in poverty, younger people, Black and brown people, much more likely to vote in presidential years than in the off-year cycles. So here you've got two women. No matter what, this is going to be a historic choice. Is that low turnout likely to push towards one of these women or the other, given that in this case, you're not talking about necessarily diversifying between them?
That's a great question. I think the short answer is that we're going to have to wait and see. We have seen the candidates already turn their attention to voters in the majority Black and brown precincts who overwhelmingly came out for one of the candidates that did not advance into the election. And it's up to them, I think, to activate those folks and see if they can roll them in and increase turnout.
Right. So none of the Black women candidates made the final cut, including the current acting mayor, Kim Janey. Are you hearing anything from Black Bostonians about this?
Yeah, I am. There are a lot of folks, though not all, of course, because Black people are not a monolith, but there are. Yes, of course. Who knew? But there are a lot of folks who were really motivated at the prospect of having a duly elected Black woman to lead the city of Boston. I think it's tied to the city's history of racism, most vividly seen in footage of what it was like when forced desegregation began here. And I'm not sure that folks have ever really had a chance to publicly wrestle with that here. And I think that prospect of a Black woman mayor made a pathway for talking about it more openly.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that, you know, on the one hand, this question of education is at the top of voters' minds. And there was this kind of moment where we thought, oh my goodness, is Boston going to wrestle with education with a Black mayor, given their particular history? I guess we will have to wait and see if that particular historic possibility reemerges at some future date. Obviously, we're going to continue to follow the mayoral race. We hope that you will come back and hang out with us again. Saraya Wintersmith, reporter covering Boston City Hall for GBH News. Saraya, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. In 1850, a Harvard professor commissioned photographs of enslaved Black people. He sought to use photography, a cutting-edge technology at the time, to gather evidence for his scientific theory. It was a theory claiming Black and white people were descended from different origins. You see, he believed the measurements and features of Black faces and bodies indicated they were not the same kind of humans that white people were. In short, this Harvard professor was collecting photographs of Black people to support the righteousness of intergenerational chattel bondage. In 2019, Tamara Lanier discovered that her ancestors were two of the enslaved Black people who were forced to submit to these photographs. The images of her ancestors, initially collected by this racist professor, were still owned and used by Harvard University. So, she asked Harvard to grant her control of the images. The university said no. In The Dark Underside of Representations of Slavery, a recent piece for The Atlantic, journalist Latreia Graham writes about Tamara's ongoing legal action against Harvard and reflects on its connection to a larger struggle for Black autonomy. She asks, are Black people ever afforded the opportunity to rest in peace?
Back in 2010, after her mother passed, she wanted to get a better picture of her genealogy. So she spoke with a couple of acquaintances and started pulling together what she knew of her ancestry. A colleague helped her find this photo of a man named Renty. She'd been told stories about Renty since she was a small child, and found this photo, and they were able to trace it back to Harvard's archives. And she found out that photos of her ancestors resided within this institution.
Okay. How is it that Harvard ended up with pictures of Tamara's basically great-great-grandma and grandpa?
There was a professor and scientist at Harvard in the 1800s. His name was Louis Agassiz. He was well known as a scientist and zoologist. And he commissioned these photos from Joseph T. Zeeley, who was a photographer that had a studio in Columbia, South Carolina, in order to try to prove some scientific theories that he was working on. And
we should probably put scientific in like air quotes if you can see
right. them. Right. We now call it pseudoscience. But at the time, he believed there was this theory, just like we have evolution, he believed in something called polygenism, which was the idea that Black people were created as a separate race from white people. And those theories and that pseudoscience became the foundation of a justification for slavery and some of the things that were eventually perpetuated to Black people.
Latreia explains the details of the inhumanity Renty, Delia, and other enslaved Black people endured during this process.
In order to prove this theory, he was taking a lot of measurements of heads and things like this. And so he had several enslaved people. He was very interested in enslaved people from Africa, right? And he had their heads measured. He had them stripped naked and had this photographer take photos from multiple sides of their bodies in order to sort of describe them differently from white people like him.
And perhaps even worse is what happened after the images were created.
They go into a drawer after that, and someone rediscovers them again about 50 years ago. And then they start grappling with what these photos mean, what to do with these photos, and they go into the archives where you have to sign documents in order to look at them.
The defiance and non-consent in the faces of these enslaved people is clearly visible. Returning their images to a direct descendant seems like at least one way to set right this wrong that was committed. But Harvard has declined to do so.
There's a certain amount of prestige to these photos that I don't think that we can ignore. These are some of the first images of enslaved people. That we know of, right, that exist. And Harvard, being a school that has cachet, I went to an Ivy, I understand prestige and cachet, that means something to them. And there is a great reluctance to let them go. Also, perhaps because they believe that they can store them better than other institutions and things like that. But that's not what happened. Harvard says, you know, in some ways that these photos reside in our collection. You don't have any right or any interest to these photos. And thus, she decided to put together a lawsuit, hoping to have some agency over the photos. And I think it's important to note, it's not like she wants to take these photos of Renty and Delia home and sit them on the mantle, right? She wants them to go to another institution, preferably in my conversation with her, a Black institution that she believes can be a better steward of this legacy and history and find a way of separating it from the white supremacy that is the foundation of some of these institutions like Harvard.
I asked Latreia whether or not Harvard University is profiting from the licensing of these images.
In her lawsuit, Lanier alleges that they are profiting off of the visages of Renty and Delia, and that in some ways, because their images are trotted out to be put on the front of conference pamphlets and they're put on the front of books, that these, her ancestors are still working. And mm-hmm. So we don't know if the press, Harvard declined to comment on some of the questions that I asked about the policy around licensing and the photos pre-2010 when this case starts to ramp up and come to light. So we don't have an answer about whether or not they were profiting off of these photos. But there is, again, this prestige and cachet conversation that we have about them having these photos.
I get the sense that this case for Tamara Lanier is about more than money.
When I spoke to her, the conversation in many ways was about reparations and finding a way to make peace with a terrible thing, a predatory thing that had happened to her family Because if it was simply about dollars and cents, there were ways that this could have been handled. It seems to be mostly about actual control over the images.
Control, autonomy, those are interesting concepts when you look at what's been taken from Black people without consent in the United States. Just take the case of Henrietta Lacks. She's a Black woman who scientists took cells from her body. And those cells over the years have led to major medical breakthroughs. But none of the profits from those achievements have come back to her descendants or even to her broader geographic and racial community. It all made me wonder whether Latreia was surprised by Tamara Lanier's story.
This is just one case in a series of examples of times that Black people have been exploited and that attributes or assets that they had are still working for a larger, mostly white-centric community. So there are a couple of things, a couple of different examples like that, and this is just one case.
If the Black body is constantly doing work well past death, how does it ever rest? Especially in an age of digital anxiety, when so many things like images are very easily manipulated.
It's a little horrifying to think about, right? There's a lot of digital anxiety, at least on my part, in thinking about this, because it's not too far to think about the Whitney Houston hologram that's going to start performing, the Tupac hologram. People were really freaked out about the Anthony Bourdain voice technology is moving so much faster than we can. And we're already seeing instances of this in some ways with my heritage's deep nostalgia technology, where you're able to take photos of people and make them move, right? Whether it's from side, their eyes move from side to side, or you feel like you have some connection. There is technology is being used as a tool to try to keep people around in some ways, or forge some sort of emotional connection through movement, through performance, things like that. And right now, there's no legislation or anything that really gives the Black body rest. It's horrifying to think of as a creative in some ways. The only thing that I can hope is that I leave behind enough portraits and enough audio and video that maybe people don't try to resurrect me in some ways, or that I'm not being called on to perform or become an emblem for a movement or a moment beyond the one that I'm living in.
Creation should be a joyful process. What we make in this world should live beyond ourselves. But this is difficult to accomplish when there isn't consent to create, or a willingness to leave these things to the world.
In this piece, I talk about Renty and Delia and their lack of consent. And on the other hand, I talk about Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass and how they use their images as formerly enslaved people that then emancipate themselves in order to move things forward. And the difference there is very much is consent, right? It is, they are choosing how they want to be seen. Sojourner Truth used to sell small portraits of her in order to fund some of her abolition lectures and her tours. And that is a decision that she made. Whereas someone that has decided to create a portrait or a painting of someone that was a victim of police brutality and then sell it and keep the money or gain notoriety and fame, like nothing is going back to that family or those descendants. Nothing is changing for the immediate family members of these people, the folks that are the closest to the trauma and the terror in many cases.
For me, I actually think some public figures are larger than the control of just their genetic family and descendants. Many of us feel like we have a stake in the legacies of our larger ancestors, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Martin Luther King Jr., Frederick Douglass. I asked Latreia about Harvard's argument for keeping these images and whether it's centered around this story of going beyond genetic descendants.
they have allowed historians to start talking about what they believe the lives of Rinty and Delia. And again, these are only two of a number of enslaved people that were photographed by Zeeley. It's just that this particular descendant has come forward. So in some ways it does open up a Pandora's box. You know, if this descendant, you know, claims the rights or believes they have a right to these photographs, right? What if the descendants for these other photographs come forward, right? And in some ways possibly depletes a collection. But again, they may see themselves as a steward or trying to make recompense in their own way. I know that Harvard is doing some of that soul searching that the rest of America is doing. And I think it will take time. It will take a number of years for all of this to be untangled.
Pandora gets a bad rap. Sometimes you got to open up the messy stuff in order to get to the truth. And I feel like in so many ways, that is what your piece did. Journalist Latreia Graham, thank you for joining us and bringing us some hard questions.
Yeah, thank you. Those questions were, they were hard for me too.
All right, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And as always, we appreciate you tuning in. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway, and we're going to be back with you tomorrow.